In 1859, at the age of 23, Mr. Bradley had lived in a number of towns throughout New England, settling briefly in Springfield, Massachusetts, where he finally found employment as a mechanical draftsman. Seeking more, Bradley went to Providence, Rhode Island, to study lithography, returning to Springfield to open that town's first lithography shop. Bradley found great success with his lithograph of the little-known presidential candidate Abraham Lincoln, a lithograph that sold quite well until Mr. Lincoln decided to grow a beard. At this point, those who had purchased Bradley's fine lithograph demanded refunds since the picture was no longer valid. Despondent, Bradley burned his remaining stock of the lithographs of the beardless Abraham Lincoln. What was a poor lithographer to do? Having been introduced to European board games by a friend, Bradley set out to apply his prowess in lithography to this new medium. In 1860, Bradley, that is, Milton Bradley, released his Checkered Game of Life, a game in which players would spin a teetotum, a sort of calibrated top, and advance through life's perils and triumphs, past prison, ruin, and suicide, with the goal of achieving 100 points before demise. The game sold well and was followed by others, catering to Americans' newly found leisure time. There, things remained for the next 100 years, until 1960, when the game was modernized to reflect the current zeitgeist. Players progressed through the updated game, getting married, having children, buying homeowners insurance, all presumably on a single income. The teetotum was replaced by a spinner, and the game remains popular to this day. 10 years later, John Horton Conway was working on a very different sort of game of life, one that did not require the 2 to 6 players of Milton Bradley's game. In fact, Conway described his game of life as a 0-player game. I'm Josh Young, and this is Playing Odd, a podcast about complexity and information in the natural world. Episode 8, The Meaning of Life. John Conway was a mathematician interested in cellular automata. Cellular, in this context, means confined within a matrix of cells, rather than being cellular in the biological sense. This matrix, in 2 dimensions, looks like a very large checkerboard. In fact, we can think of it as an infinitely large checkerboard in which squares can either be empty and white or completely filled and black. In digital terms, each square can have a value of 0 or of 1. The game progresses in turns in which each square in the matrix either keeps its current value or changes its value from 0 to 1 or vice versa, depending upon the value of neighboring squares. The idea of cellular automata predates Conway's work, having been invented, as were so many things, by John von Neumann, in collaboration with Stanislaw Ulam. Von Neumann has already appeared in the series of podcasts. Ulam is best known for, along with Edward Teller, developing the hydrogen bomb. Von Neumann had developed an interest in the replication of complex systems. In order to replicate itself, a complex system, for example, a living organism, must have both the instructions for the replication process as well as the machinery to perform the replication. Since the system must contain all the information about itself as well as containing a replication mechanism, it sounds as if it should be impossible for a complex system to actually replicate. And yet, here we are. Von Neumann envisioned machines that, emulating life, could replicate themselves. This line of thought led to the idea of von Neumann probes, which are machines that would be launched into space and would replicate themselves with available material, as well as machines that could alter their own instruction set to produce a sort of directed evolution. Von Neumann's mathematical framework for developing ideas of replication in complex systems was cellular automata. he developed patterns and rule sets that could duplicate themselves and named these universal constructors. Incredibly, he did this all without the aid of computers. The von Neumann machines, as they've become known, would appear to be rather threatening. Perhaps the idea of a space probe replicating itself is not something about which we have to worry, but self-replicating nanotechnology would certainly represent an existential threat. Having said this, the inventor of the term gray goo to describe a catastrophe of ecophagy has emphasized that the likelihood of such runaway replication is very small. It seems to me that interest in and fear of nanotechnology has been replaced in popular media by interest in and fear of artificial intelligence. John Conway's innovation in 1970 was to develop a set of four rules that would govern whether any particular cell changed its state and frame these rules as if they governed reproduction and sustenance of life. The rules are, 1, any live, that is to say filled cell, with fewer than two live neighbors, dies, as if by underpopulation. Any live cell with two or three live neighbors lives on to the next generation. Any live cell with more than three live neighbors dies as if by overpopulation. And any dead cell with exactly three live neighbors becomes a live cell as if by reproduction. The player, more a sort of prime mover, arranges the initial pattern of cells, and then the game proceeds, turn by turn, on its own without further intervention by the player. Depending upon the initial pattern chosen, all of the cells may vanish and the entire system remains, as Conway would put it, lifeless. In other situations, the pattern will self-propagate and remain present, often in a cyclical form, for eternity. However, in many cases, a pattern will develop over a large number of turns, either to collapse entirely or to become cyclical. Conway's game of life was demonstrated to be capable of universal computation, but interesting as that is, I will not explore that topic any further. You and I now have the technical language to describe and understand Conway's game of life. It is a deterministic system, since there are no stochastic or random elements. This is a system that can develop into a state that is cyclical, that is to say periodic, or a state that is chaotic and aperiodic. You will recall in our discussions of deterministic aperiodic systems when we discuss chaos theory and the Lorentz attractor. In experimenting with Conway's game of life, Stephen Wolfram, a polymath and inventor of Mathematica, made a number of important observations, one of which is pertinent to our project of developing a brain. He found patterns that remained acyclical for more than 100 turns before developing into cyclical patterns or vanishing entirely. Moreover, he found that no formula, no algorithm, could predict what the outcome of the initial pattern would be without going through each of the intermediate turns of the game of life. That is to say, there was no computation that was able to determine the outcome in any fewer steps than the game itself took. He referred to this property as computational irreducibility. I want to highlight two things about computational irreducibility. The first is that we have already encountered it in our discussion of Laplace's demon back in episode 6. We said that even if the universe were deterministic, Laplace's demon would still be useless for prediction because it would be unable to calculate the future of the universe any faster than 1 second per second. This is just another way of saying that the universe, in its detail, is computationally irreducible. The other point I wish to make is to prevent any confusion between computational irreducibility, which is an important topic in complexity science, with irreducible complexity, which sounds similar, but is a fallacy promulgated by creationists. Irreducible complexity claims that a structure as complicated as the eye could not have evolved because it functions only in its full development and does nothing when only partially evolved. The eye is the example generally cited, despite the fact that an immense evolutionary record of eye development exists, demonstrating the fallacy of the idea of irreducible complexity. I will discuss this idea no further since I have no truck with it, and bring it up only because it sounds similar to the phrase that we are now using, computational irreducibility, with which it has no overlap. It is well and good for me to say that many biological processes are computationally irreducible, but an example will make the point clearer, and this example comes from a fairy tale. In the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack trades his cow for some magical seeds. He does not know what these seeds will produce when he trades his cow for them. Should Jack have known? Indeed, if you were to get a seed from a plant nursery, a seed that you did not recognize, is there any way that you would know into what sort of plant it would grow? In fact, if you were an established botanist and came across a seed of shape and color that you did not recognize, would you be able to, even by dissecting it, determine what would be the appearance of the adult plant? The seed is the embodiment of the problem of computational irreducibility. We cannot know what plant the seed will be until the seed grows into it. If the process of growth to identifiability takes 30 days, there is no process, no algorithm, that will allow identification in a shorter time. Perhaps, I hear you interject, we could do genetic testing on the seed to find its closest relatives. But if that were the case, the seed would not be truly novel to us. A truly novel seed cannot be accelerated in declaring itself. This trivial fact is of profound importance for the field of computational biology, or theoretical biology as it is also known. Many biological systems, indeed many non-biological systems, cannot be solved for, but can only be simulated or predicted statistically. Even in the greatly simplified and entirely deterministic framework of Conway's Game of Life, the flourishing of an initial pattern cannot be solved for, only simulated. And what if our project to understand neurogenesis? Isn't the fertilized egg that will ultimately grow to be a human? Isn't that egg a seed? And does this mean that we have to abandon our project of getting from seed to brain? Well, not entirely. We may not be able to get from a specific genome to a specific brain, but we still have a great deal of road left to travel. What does this mean of our project from getting from genome to connectome? Have we, by recognizing that computational irreducibility is intrinsic to neurogenesis, moved the goalposts so far that our project is now meaningless? I think the answer is no, because we must still start with a genome, with genetic expression, with genes. And there are no genes for complexity. There are no genes for systems. There are no genes for intelligence or language or height or any of these things. There are only genes for proteins. And it is this journey from genetics to complexity that will begin our episode next week. In this week's program, we learned of von Neumann's quest for self-replication and John Conway's zero-player game of cellular automata. We saw with interest that some patterns can reproduce themselves and that it may be impossible to predict outcomes faster than the systems themselves evolve. We understood that this must somehow lead back to genetics and began to wonder how we get from protein to complexity. I want to thank you, kind listener, for taking this journey through complexity with me. A bibliography for this episode, along with links to additional material, can be found at playingodd.com. I hope this program will serve as an opening to a broader conversation. Please write to me with your questions or comments at josh@playingodd.com. Looking forward to spending time with you next week. I'm Josh Young.